get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, what a week. I almost don't know where to start. Major shifts underway on a number of fronts in the U.S. and global economy that are going to be very interesting to see how they play out in the next weeks and months. Well, what are they? Right now, of course, we see this major correction beginning in the stock and bond markets. We've been talking about the bubbles in the stock market, U.S. and elsewhere, and, of course, bond bubble that preceded it, and now they seem to be unraveling together. We've got today, so far, day's not over, a 400-point decline in the stock market. And we've had multi-hundred-point declines here so far this week. This is the week that was for U.S. stocks. Money is flowing out. Savvy investors know it's near the top and time to get out before it actually tops out. And they're doing that. They're moving their money around. Same with bonds, because it looks like rates are rising. And they're moving their money elsewhere, offshore, or parking it on the side, waiting to see what happens. So we have a big correction going on. It looks very much to me like what I experienced and watched in March 2000. March 2000, of course, was the beginning of the dot-com NASDAQ stock bubble bust. And it was marked by churning at the top, and froth and so forth. And then, of course, we got the crack in the bubble here. It's beginning in March. And it played out after that. The tech crash spilled over to manufacturing. And after that, spilled over to other areas of the economy, service areas. And what we got was a general correction, major correction, that led the way to the recession of 2001, which began at the first quarter of 2001, and then was interfered with by 9/11, which led the U.S. government to big pump up of fiscal war spending that sort of stopped the recession in its tracks. And we got a minor recession as a result in 2001. Well, you know, today defense and war spending doesn't have that big an impact on jobs that it used to have. It's much more tech-oriented today, and a lot of the war production is shared with U.S. allies. So don't expect a big job push from this. It will have a bigger effect should stocks decline here on consumer spending at the high end, which was really the only place it was going on, except for at the working class end, where spending was not based on wage and income growth, but based upon debt, massive new debt levels, and a crash in the savings rate, people drawing money out of savings and spending it. The U.S. Savings rate at the end of this past year dropped to 2.4%. 2.4%, that's plunging, right? That will soon reverse, of course, as people encounter more economic troubles in the real economy. But, okay, I don't want to get into that. We've talked about that. But the first big event here this week is stock and bond market big correction underway. And, of course, as I had predicted, when I discussed in recent weeks the likely trajectory of Bitcoin and crypto cryptocurrency developments in 2018. I had predicted we're going to see a big correction, and that could be either leading the stock and bond market correction or following it. Well, it's clearly following it, but other forces that were driving up crypto and Bitcoin prices to celestial levels here in 2017 are now reversed. They flipped, and that's why we're getting this big correction, which isn't over, by the way. Crypto, Bitcoin had hit almost $20,000 a coin, well over 19, and now it was at 10, and it's going to go lower still. And the other cryptos are going to be even more harshly hit here. So more contraction in Bitcoin is surely on the agenda. And it's beginning to leak out that one of the reasons is the big holders of Bitcoin who got in early and created these Bitcoin initial coin offerings and so forth are dumping, taking their profits. They started doing this in December, taking their profits and running. Speculators, professional speculators who drove the market up. And the market up was driven by a number of forces I've written about. Go read my blog, jackrasmus.com, or my article in early January in the European Financial Review, which predicted what's going on now, in which I indicated that the reason for the run-up in 2017 was the lack of regulation and therefore the lack of taxation. With regulation comes taxation eventually. And the ability to opaquely manipulate these crypto coin prices. And it really got to a fever pitch later in 2017, this manipulation. And the demand, of course, was driving it up. And behind the scenes, the speculators were manipulating this stuff, especially the early adopters who started these crypto mining services, manipulating, pumping and dumping, as they call it, of the prices. And now it's beginning to leak out how they were doing this. And what happened was it went too far, and it started affecting real stock, other company stock prices. Well, how? Well, these other companies in trouble simply changed their name, added blockchain to the name of the company, and blockchain riot and stuff like that, right? Companies that had nothing to do with cryptocurrencies or blockchain simply added that to their name, like Ice Tea Company in Long Island added the name blockchain, changed its name, and its stock price doubled, tripled overnight. And that's how these companies are saving themselves, or trying to for a while. And of course, when the whole phenomenon of cryptos began affecting regular securities, equities, stocks, that brings in the Security Exchange Commission, which came in with a vengeance at the end of last year, and now is beginning to deepen its regulatory declarations and investigating these companies that simply changed their name as a way of boost their prices. And speculators jumped into these companies, by the way, and used it to manipulate, use blockchain to manipulate the prices and drive it up. Kind of like not dissimilar to financial speculators, hedge fund guys and so forth, who jumped into the drug market, prescription drug market here a couple of years ago after 2015, bought up these orphan drugs and doubled, tripled, quadrupled, thousands, raised prices thousands of times. We've been writing and talking about that for a couple of years now. Well, it was the Wall Street got their hand into the prescription drug market and manipulated prices, because that's what Wall Street does. It manipulates prices. Wall Street doesn't have any products. They just make money for money by manipulating prices to whatever extent they can on financial assets. Well, that's what I talked about in my Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy book at some length, chapter 11 and 12. Very similar phenomenon occurring with blockchain. You know, these high-risk speculators jumped into the market. And, of course, it got legitimized in 2017 with the creation of the commodity futures trading facilities at the end of the year. And that drove the demand as well. And a lot of even governments were legitimizing it, and that drove the demand. And, all of that, no regulation, no taxation, speculation, hidden and legitimation, all that drove the Bitcoin prices to record levels. Well, all that's reversed. You know, at the end of the year, central bankers got together in Europe and they figured, well, we got to stop this thing. And the regulatory bodies are in line with them now. And what we got are this a wave of regulatory declarations and investigations going on. And of course, the big controllers of the supply saw this as a signal to sell. And that added to the downward pressure, right? When you collapse demand because people think it's going to be regulated now, and you also dump supply on the market, well, both supply and demand forces drive down the price. And now we have the stock and bond market corrections on top of it, which has a negative effect on risk-taking, you see, and that impacts the crypto market. So crypto markets, watch out, prices are going lower here. All right, that's all I have to say about cryptos. Now, you know, why do we have the stock and bond correction? Because it's a bubble, and big investors figure they got what they can squeeze out of it. The bubble, of course, in stocks, driven by this massive tax cut, at least in the U.S., and then it spills over with a contagion effect to other markets around the world. But the massive handout by the Trump administration with this big tax cut, an immediate adding to the bottom line of corporations on average of 10 to 31%. Bottom line profit boost, 10 to 31%, you know, maybe average 20, 25%, right? Wouldn't you like to get a 25% raise? What would you do with it? You'd probably spend some of it, right? Well, you know, the corporations are going to spend some of it too. Oh, but what do they spend it on? Well, if you believe the Trump nonsense, they're going to invest in expanding production in the U.S. and hiring more people. And that will generate wage increases and more consumption and higher GDP and lower deficit. All nonsense. Nonsense. The consumer is tapped out, is debt overloaded, is taking money out of savings, right? And there is no real wage increase coming. Well, wait a minute. Isn't there a 2.6% increase in wages reported by the Labor Department? Well, that's nominal wages. Nominal, meaning not adjusted for inflation. When you adjust it for inflation, you know, you got less than 0.5% annual growth. And some figures, when you look at supervisory non-production, supervisory workers, it's a whopping 4 cents an hour increase last year. There's no wage growth going on. Not for the mass of 100 million working class folks. No wage increase going on. And if you're tapped out on debt and you've tapped out your savings, well, where's the consumption going to come from? It's not going to come, is the question, right? And now with the stock market correction going on, the wealthiest 5% households, whose wealth effect drives their consumption, are going to contract as well. Well, there's no consumption coming anywhere. Consumption, 70% of the economy, and it's what's kept the economy up last year. That plus massive fires and hurricanes that have required hundreds of thousands of auto repurchases and home repairs and everything else that goes with it. You know, the hurricanes actually gave a boost to the economy. So did fires in California. All right. That with the massive tax cuts for corporations and businesses, I've been writing an article on that, more details on how much, really. And we're looking at $4 to $5 trillion in tax cuts for companies and investors, not $1.5 trillion, $4 to $5 trillion. Well, I'll document that. We'll talk about that maybe next week, but you can probably read an article I'll post here next week on the PRN website or my blog, jackrasmus.com. All right. So, you know, that massive tax cut, 10 to 31% profit, how's it going to be spent? Well, as I said, it's not going to go into real investment and real producing real things to hire real people. No. Where's it going to go? Well, where it's been going for 8 years, and that's into buying back stock, especially with stock prices falling. Companies are going to take even a bigger chunk of this free profit boost, subsidization by the government and the state. They're going to take even a bigger part to try to stem the decline in their stock prices. They're going to buy back even more stocks, and they're going to pay out even more dividends. Because if they pay out dividends, high dividends give a positive reason for people buying stock, you know, non-corporation, not buying their own stock, new purchasers of the stock. So with the correction in the stock market, you're going to see even more dividends and buybacks by corporations. More than what? Well, for 6 years, U.S. companies have been spending $1 trillion a year, every year, buying back their stocks and paying out dividends, over $1 trillion a year. Now, with corporations with 10 to 31% more profit, well, they're going to continue doing that. What else do they do with that massive amount of free money they got from the Federal Reserve and now from Trump in fiscal tax cutting? What else do they do with it besides buy back stock and pay out more dividends? Well, they invest offshore. They move the money offshore, right? Or they sit on it and hoard it, right? Because now they can sit on more because the tax rates are going to be so low. That's where the massive amount in the last 6 years of corporate profits went. It didn't go into investing in real things because the investment rate, the real investment rate, slowly declined. You know, long term, since 2008. And because it slowly declines, productivity slowly falls. And productivity has been falling. And if productivity falls, that means corporate and businesses' cost, unit labor costs, rise. And if their costs are rising, they don't give wage increases. They take it out on wages. Wages stagnate because productivity falls. Well, productivity falls because real investment slows. And real investment slows because the massive subsidization going on by the capitalist state of corporate America, and not just America, all advanced economies, this massive subsidization is flowing into financial asset markets. That's the big shift in the 21st century. I talk about that in great length in Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy. Check out my website, where I'm running a series of articles on the concluding chapter about, you know, states the theoretical basis for all of this shift, the relative shift from real investment to financial asset investment, which doesn't create any jobs or boost the economy in any way, shape, or form. Okay, so what we got going on here is, once again, with the tax cuts, subsidization by the government. In this case, Congress and the presidency. Prior to this, under Obama, we had subsidization by the central bank, by Ben Bernanke, chair, and then Janet Yellen, who is leaving now. And the question is, what will the Federal Reserve Bank do under this new guy, Powell? We will see. We will see. By the way, one of my other conclusions in my most recent book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, is that they cannot raise interest rates much higher. Maybe another half or 0.75 basis points, and that's it. That's it, because they will precipitate a credit crisis if they do so. Well, they're well on their way. They're only maybe a half of a full percent away from that, what I consider and think is the max, is the ceiling that they're going to be able to raise these rates. They'll be caught between a rock and a hard place. That's why the book is called Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. Well, they're going to raise interest rates. That's rising as the bond prices rise. But they can't do it much further. We will see. We will see. There's this benchmark rate called the federal funds rate, which is at 1.5%, which just yesterday the Federal Reserve decided not to raise, but they will raise it in March. But I think 2 to 2.25% is the ceiling. And if they're going to raise it 0.25% 4 more times this year, they're going to exceed that ceiling. So at some time this year, who knows exactly when, maybe the next 0.25% hike in March, maybe 0.5% later, they're going to have to stop because it's going to have counter effects here and slow down the economy dramatically. We're already seeing the U.S. economy in trouble. Autos now that got a last 6 months of last year, a little boost with the hurricanes and replacement costs of autos, and then deep, deep discounts, right? Autos now will clearly turn down as rates rise, financing rates and so forth. And we're already seeing that happen at Ford. And other companies will follow suit. Watch it. Auto is very important. And, of course, rising rates will slow down the housing sector as well, which it is already doing. So, two major sectors of the economy, and we're running a big trade deficit that's growing. In other words, we're buying more and more stuff from other countries, and they're buying less from us. And as the dollar rises, they will buy even less from us. So what we got here is a big problem with the U.S. economy, housing and autos and exports, and on top of that, consumption not being wage-driven, and the big animal spirits released this past year, investment spirits, in other words, by the Trump a tax cut. There has been some investing going on in business, contrary to the long-term trend for 1 year, but that's going to dissipate quick as inventory buildup, runs into the wall of lack of consumption growth, and they're going to pull back, no doubt. So the scenario, as I said, recession U.S. 2019. All right. So Yellen ending here. On February 1st, big event in the past week, Bitcoin and altcoins collapsing in price, stock and bond market, big correction underway, right? And Trump's speech was very important this past week. For my analysis of that Trump speech, go to my my blog, jackrasmus.com. My analysis was entitled A Long on Theater and Short on Policy. And that's exactly what happened. It was an incredibly ineffective speech, I thought. Unless, of course, you're one of these fact-blind right-wingers who just love to hear all the emotional bullshit that comes out of these theatrical events called the Presidential State of the Union speeches, right? If you watch these speeches, they're really theatrical. Where the president offers a short sentence about how wonderful America is, cuts short his sentence and waits for applause. Congress rises and claps, usually longer than the sentence that brought them to their feet. This goes on every 15 seconds, sometimes less. Up, down, go the congressman, right? Turn off the volume and it's similar to canned laughter in a TV situation comedy, except that instead of the laughter, you got the visual effect of bouncing butts every couple of seconds, right? Yeah. You know, if you were a first-time viewer of these presidential speeches, you know, you'd wonder, wow, is there something wrong with their backsides? Up, down, up, down? Hmm? And then when people are about to get tired of watching the up, down, and the incessant clapping, then the president introduces these stage character actors in the gallery above the floor, right? And each one providing an appeal to the TV audience's emotions. There were no fewer than 12 of these gallery scenes, breaking up the mesmerizing talk, rise, clap, sit down nonsense, right? What were they? Well, there's Ashley the helicopter lady, you know, Dolberg the firefighter. And then they even introduced this guy Scalise, this congressman, whose only claim to fame was he got himself shot, right? Definitely not at the level of the other, quote, heroes, right? And then he introduces Trump. Trump introduces this 12-year-old kid, Preston the flag boy, right, who put flags on graves and so forth, and says he had a great conversation with the kid. Yeah, I'm sure it was a comparable intellect. But by far, the gallery events that were most significant, I think, were about these family members. He introduced four black family parents, right? Two pairs of parents whose kids were killed by this Long Island gang, the MS-13. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they were all black, as if, you know, MS-13 didn't kill any whites, right? Because he used this to blunt the racist appeal of what he was actually going to say about immigration, you see. And then he introduced this ICE agent guy named Martinez, again, you know, Hispanic, a person of color, to blunt what was coming, which was going to be very, very, very racist, right? What he really used this was to take an attack on chain migration. Chain migration is where a person comes over, becomes naturalized citizen, and then can bring family members over. You know, they want to stop that. The Republicans want to stop chain migration. All right. And that led directly into this DACA, Dreamer Kids, issue here. And Trump made it clear that he wants three things in exchange for some deal on DACA. He wants to spend over $30 billion on a border wall. He wants only merit-based immigration. In other words, welcome all you Norwegians, right? And an end to the chain migration policy. And he said this would protect the nuclear family, right? As if saying, okay, white folks, nuclear families are good, and immigrant folks, especially Latino extended families, are bad, right? That's the logic, right? So if he gets the pillars 1, 2, 3 that he wants, in other words, the wall, end of chain migration, right, and merit-based only immigration, then maybe he will agree for some deal for citizenship for these 800,000 dreamers. But not before 2030, you see? 12 years. 12 years. They have to wait 12 years, and who knows what hoops they're going to have to jump through. That's what he's offered the Democrats here. That's the deal. Of course, they may take the deal because, you know, they said Democrats said they had a line in the sand here a couple of weeks ago. They shut down a government or without a deal on the Dreamers, and then they chickened out, right, as Democrats wimpily tend to do nowadays, at least the party leaders, you know, the Schumers and Pelosi's, who are really aligned with the money bags in the party, you know, not the Progressive Caucus and the Sandernistas and so forth. Not them, but they are a minority. They, you know, they're the tail on the dog of the Democratic Party, right? So, you know, that was the most interesting development in terms of the gallery effect. The other one, of course, was he talked about the opioid crisis, right? Opioid crisis in America, where 60,000 Americans die every year from overdoses. Hmm? That's a Vietnam War death accounting every year, You know, it took 8 years in Vietnam for 58,000 Americans to die. Well, 60,000 a year, every year. We have a Vietnam going on every year. And what does the government and Trump do? Nothing. Nothing. He says, let's get tough on drug dealers in his speech. But he fails to mention the drug dealers who were really behind all this are the prescription drug companies themselves, who pushed their fentanyl and Percocet on doctors a decade ago, telling them drugs weren't addictive. And of course, they created a whole generation of people addicted to opioid-like painkillers, right? That's the real problem. The other real problem with the drugs is the runaway costs and the price gouging, which he's doing nothing about either. You know, he had a press conference several weeks ago where he talked about the opioid crisis and then offered no specifics about how to deal with it. Well, when he says we're going to get tough on the opioid drug dealers, right? Don't believe it, right? Watching Trump solve the opioid crisis will be slower than watching grass grow in winter. All right, so, you know, I'm not going to talk about that bozo and his speeches anymore. Except to say, you know, there's nonsense about $4,000 a year for median families from his tax cuts. And then he talked about the tax cuts a little bit, but, you know, rather than go into that here at this point, I want to cover some other stuff. Just read my article on my blog about the tax cut nonsense. Go to jackrasmus.com, right? And the article is there on his speech. And on the tax cut thing. And of course, you know, his threats and divisions in the rest of his speech. I found very interesting, too, about his ominous threat to, quote, remove government employees, unquote, who, quote, fail the American people or undermine American trust. Ooh, sounds like a warning across the bow to the bureaucracy, not to cross him or else. And then he slams the National Football League players for not saluting the flag and says he's about to expand Guantanamo and the U.S. nuclear arsenal. And then adds the fact he reaffirms the definition of enemy combatants, which, of course, if you're not aware of it, can be leveled against U.S. citizens. And if so, then they can throw you in, incarcerate you somewhere. And your habeas corpus rights are eliminated. Yeah, the Constitution with the you know, the whole Patriots Act after 2001 and NDAA laws passed every year, the state now has the power to take away your constitutional rights and your right to be charged and have an attorney. I mean, they can hide you. Right, if you're an enemy combatant, and he's in favor of that. Well, this is all part of the attack on civil liberties that's been going on for over a decade now, and he says I'm all for it. Really, that's it, right? And then on foreign policy, of course, new sanctions against Cuba and Venezuela, but he and possibility of withholding funding from the UN. But the real statement was. North Korea. And this is where the theater ends, where he introduces this guy, Seong Ho, brought all the way from South Korea. And Ho stands there up in the gallery and raises his crutches because he's legless, you see. And oh, that's, you know, big emotional appeal. And then he just runs into his final emotional appeal. That's what's great about America are Americans themselves, is his statement, his theme. You're great. I'm great, but you're great. Well, too bad he doesn't mean all Americans. He just means some. All right, so that's the speech. Go read it, my analysis, if you want. But it's a new low in presidential addresses. You know? All emotion used as a vehicle for him to reassert his attack on civil liberties and attack on the Dreamers and immigration and so forth. That's what it was all about. And all emotion, all theater. Okay. So let's move on. hear what else beside the Trump speech, the Yellen era ending, and the financial asset markets collapsing was important last week. Well, I want to talk about wages. I want to talk about the condition of the working class in America. I don't know if I'll have time to finish it all here today. You know, part of this whole lie thing with Trump and the Republicans is that all wages are rising. Oh, wages are recovering, right? No. As I said, if you look just at nominal wages and don't adjust it for inflation, well, you got an over 2% increase, right? And besides, what are wages? It depends what government database you're looking at. You know, if you look at Commerce Department data, wages, two-thirds of profits of non-corporate companies, business income, are considered wages. Two-thirds are considered wages of individual proprietors. Well, those aren't wages. Yeah, but they consider them wages. All right. So, you know, there's lots of ways of looking at what are wages. You can look at average wages, and average wages, you know, might be rising because the salaries of the CEOs and managers and professionals at the top end of the labor force are rising double digits and driving the average wage up. By wages, do you mean earnings? Are you including hours of work? Is it just hourly pay you're talking about? Is it non-supervisory production and service employees? Are we counting compensation, which means paying more, companies having to pay more now for health care or pensions or whatever? Is it compensation? Right? There's all kinds of indicators of what wages really are. Well, if you look at the private sector wages of workers, you know, non-government workers. I don't know why we would cut out non-government or cut out government workers. You know, we got 22 million government workers, but the data for wages for government workers, non-government workers, the private sector, you know, seems to be rising, but actually, it's not. They're really not. Well, if you look at non-supervisory hourly wage and salary workers in this country, about 110 million of them, right? The average hourly wage is $22.50. That reduces to about $44,600 a year if you figure you work 2,000 hours. There's 2,080 hours for 40-hour work week in the year. Now, the important thing, well, there's lots of important things about this figure, is that it's really for full-time workers, you see? They don't factor in part-time workers, right? Or others who are not getting full hours of work, and they aren't 40-hour-a-week or 30 to 40-hour-a-week workers, right? Though their wages aren't part of this $22.50 and $44,600 per year. Now, that's a problem. It means the numbers are even lower than they are. And of course, if you adjust for inflation and seasonality, the numbers are even lower. The extent of this is visible when you look at labor share of total income, labor share, because wages are the, you know, 90% of workers' share of their income. It's 90% of their income. So if you look at labor share, even with official data, go look at the FRED, F-R-E-D database of the St. Louis Federal Reserve. It keeps this database on the economy, right? In the year 2000, right, the index for labor share was 110. And by 2012, it had fallen to 96. That's a 13% decline. So wages, labor share, wages and labor share had declined in this country by 13% between 2000 and 2012. A lot of that, of course, was the consequence of the collapse in 2008-9. Mm-hmm. But even more significantly, that index indicator of 96, fallen from 110, did not change. By 2017, the end of last year, it was still 96. In other words, there was no real increase in wages and labor share last year. It's at the same level it was in 2012. 5 years of so-called recovery, well, 6 years actually, no recovery in labor share and its wages. This is going on globally, by the way. If you look at IMF data that just came out, the World Economic Outlook of the IMF, in all the advanced economies, labor share has declined from 54% in 1980 to 39% in 2015, a 15% collapse in labor share. That's corroborated by data from Professor Emmanuel Saez's database at UC Berkeley. What was that? We've talked about 95% of all the growth, the income from growth since 2010, 95% has gone to the wealthiest 1% households. 95%. That compares under Bush of 65% went to the 1%. And under Clinton, 48% went to the 1%. So it's rising. They're absorbing more and more. The wealthiest 1%, who are investors and capitalists and senior managers and so forth, they're sucking it all up. Yeah, we got a recovery, but they're sucking it all up. It's all going to them, to the top. If you look at that database for the U.S. historically, too, now it's 27% in the past year. The wealthiest 1% have gotten 27% of all the national income, not the growth. You see, this 95% is the net growth over 2010. They're getting all of it, right? But if you count not just the net growth, but GDP and national income, levels in general, not just the incremental change, their amount, the 1% households amount, is at record high. It's higher than it was in 1929, 27%. That compares with their share, which was 8 to 9%, you know, for 40 years between 1940 and 1978. It was only 8-9%, but since Reagan, it's been rising, right through Democratic Party regimes too, right through Obama, right through Clinton, hasn't changed, right? And now it's at record highs, and they're saying that wages are rising, you know. And by the way, real wages are going to take a bigger hit this year because we have rising inflation in rents. Now with healthcare premiums going to go through the roof, copays and deductibles, local taxes, college education costs, rising fuel costs, all of that's going to take a bigger whack out of real wages. So we may not even get 4 cents an hour here in 2018. And yet they have the gall, the government, the policymakers, the Trumps, and Congress, they have the gall to say that wages are rising. They also have the gall to say that, oh, jobs are doing so well. Jobs are doing so well. We got all this job creation going on. Well, we have the data out today. And of course, every month, you know, we keep seeing these job creation numbers, right? Yeah, they're creating jobs, but the jobs don't pay much, you see. They're low-pay service jobs, and they are part-time temp jobs, contingent jobs. You know, we got 160 million people in the labor force today, but you know, at least 50 million or more are what we call contingent, part-time, temp, contract, independent contract, gig economy type jobs. If you look at what's happening longer term with jobs, the picture is not so good. You see, you just can't look at the recent couple years where they've been hiring all these part-time contingent jobs and full-time jobs too in the past year as they have these animal spirits released in anticipation of growth. Yeah, okay, so there are jobs, but you look at the long-term effects here. What about NAFTA, right? We've lost over 3 million jobs to NAFTA. We lost another 3 million jobs to China in emerging markets since 2000. You used to have more than 18 million people in manufacturing. What have we got now, 12? You know, we've lost 6 million jobs in manufacturing. And it's not just due to free trade losing all these jobs, but it's also tax measures, tax bills since Bush and now under Trump, which provide incentives to replace workers with machinery, with automation and robots. You know, that's whacking jobs, high-paying jobs, just as much as free trade is. They're about the same. You know, the effects of NAFTA, let's take NAFTA. The effects of NAFTA on growth, just 0.2% of GDP growth from NAFTA. In other words, we've traded 3 million jobs for 0.2% growth. Well, 0.2% GDP growth is about $50 billion a year in GDP. And if you assume that you know, wages are about half of that, $25 billion a year. And how much have we lost with 3 million jobs? $144 billion a year. So free trade, you know, generates $25 billion a year in wages, but it costs $144 billion a year in lost wages. Because the jobs created are lower paid, you see. And the jobs lost are higher paid. That's called the export-import differential. Okay, so, you know, all this jobs long-term and unemployment rate 4.1%, that's totally phony. That's the U3 unemployment rate. It only looks at full-time workers. It doesn't count these 50, 60 million people now who are contingent workers. Okay, so if you look at the U6, what's called the Labor Department's U6 unemployment rate, not the phony U3 at 4.1%, the U6 is closer to 9-10%. But even that underestimates, I believe. We should have a U9 unemployment rate that counts for the underground economy, people going on Social Security disability, and other factors that don't get recorded. A truer picture of the state, the stagnant state of the labor market, is other indicators called the labor force participation rate or the employment to population ratio. If you look at these two indicators, they've been flat. They haven't improved at all, especially the past year. Right? They're still where they are. Those are indicators of people leaving the labor force. And if you leave the labor force, you don't get counted as unemployed, you see. You may be out of work, but you're not unemployed. Oxymoron there, right? Or the EPOP, employment population ratio, which measures the ability to create jobs at a pace that the population is growing. And those are declining. The EPOP and the participation rate are stagnant or declining. And that's the true picture of the labor market, not this unemployment for a 4.1% unemployment rate. That's nonsense. It's obfuscation, right? It's what they use to make it look like things are really getting better significantly, which they aren't, right? So, you know, the 4.1 cuts out most of the labor force out there, and even the U6, the 9-10% is underestimating And the jobs that are creating are being created low-paid service jobs, insecure jobs, no benefit kind of jobs. That's what's happening. Now, the Trump tax effect is going to actually cause, I believe, a further reduction in jobs once it starts taking effect. Why? Because multinational corporations who have been hoarding trillions of dollars offshore, officially $2.8 trillion, but that's only for the Fortune 500 companies, you see. If you count 5,000 largest U.S. companies doing business abroad, the cash hoard offshore is about $4 trillion, made possible originally by Bill Clinton. He simply said, you companies doing multinational companies doing business offshore and your tax returns, just check a box and you won't have to pay the foreign profits tax on what you got offshore. So they push more money offshore, of course. So if you got $4 trillion, and now you can bring it back at 10% in tax rate instead of the 35% that was, and even the 21% that now is the figure for onshore U.S.-based corporate tax rate, nominal rate, right? If you can bring it back at 10% instead of 21 or 35, right? Why wouldn't you want to move more jobs offshore and more production offshore? We have even a lower tax rate. Plus, you can take advantage, continuing here, with these big loopholes that exist that the Trump tax bill did not address. The corporate tax inversions, for one, and other loopholes that corporate tax lawyers joke about, like they call it the double Irish and the Dutch sandwich. Okay, that's hoarding. You can hoard your money and not bring it back by moving it between the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and Ireland and the Netherlands, you see. You just keep moving it around. Google is a big player in that regard. You know, Google books all of its profits from software development in the Cayman Islands and then moves it to Ireland. Yeah. Okay, there's a lot of games there, and those games have not been touched by the Trump tax cut. But the bottom line in jobs is very clear. What's going to happen is with the 10% nominal and then even less real effective rate they'll pay when their tax lawyers get involved, you know, they'll maybe pay 5%, 4 or 5%. Well, gee, 4 or 5%, why should I move more jobs offshore? That's going to happen, I predict, right? All right, so the tax cut itself is going to undermine these job figures that we got here. But I want to say something in closing about what are long-term developments in labor markets now underway that's going to cause a even bigger whack on job creation in the U.S., you know, bigger than free trade, bigger than the tax cuts, incentive to offshore, maybe even bigger than the capital labor substitution tax incentives to replace jobs with machinery, automation. Well, what are these? What are these big three? Well, I began talking about them in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy, in chapter 13, where I discuss labor market restructurings going on in the U.S. and globally. Well, what are these major restructurings? You see, this isn't even government policy. This is the capitalists themselves figuring out how to get rid of labor and keep a bigger piece of the pie for themselves. And of course, the politicians, make it easier by passing laws that support these technological changes going on. What are they? Well, one has been going on for a while. This is the Uber effect, right? Uber effect, where you just have software, technology software, where the company, Uber in this case, or Lyft, or BNB, or whatever, there's a whole bunch of them, control the customer, and they leave it up to the workers to identify where the customer is, you see. This is all service industries, You get rid of manufacturing by sending jobs offshore, but you get rid of service jobs with Uber software technology. And the company controls where the jobs are and sends the workers there. But the workers got to use their own capital, you see. The companies don't even invest in capital except software. Well, that's a bigger margin for them. There's no cost of goods and no investment involved here except the software. And that, of course, devastates transport and devastates jobs and benefits because these workers have no benefits. So these Uber companies save all these the cost of benefits and make the workers pay for it, make the workers use their cars or whatever, the capital, and they don't have to invest the capital. Okay, so the Uber effect, the Amazon effect. Well, we see what Amazon's done to a lot of retail, and retail now is in a free fall. Next recession, goodbye Sears, goodbye Penny's, and a few others probably there. So they're devastating retail. And now Amazon's going into groceries, and watch out, grocery workers, because your jobs at the grocery stores are going to disappear, and a lot of those are union jobs. Mm-hmm. And now they just announced Jeff Bezos, the chair of Amazon, got together with Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, and they announced new initiatives in healthcare. Really, it's all about cost reduction. It's about taking the Amazon effect and adapting it to the healthcare industry. And the same thing that you had with retail now and groceries are going to happen with healthcare, and it's going to whack jobs. And, Amazon is really already developing new software to track workers' hand movements. Of course, they're going to initially hire people in these warehouses, but they have plans, Amazon, to get rid of them and use software and artificial intelligence, which I'll talk about as well. The Amazon effect, the Uber effect, and the artificial intelligence effect, which is going to be the biggest impact on jobs. We thought contingent was the problem. No. Contingent labor is going to be paled in contrast to the AI effect. Well, I'm not going to get into AI what it is right now because we're running out of time. But just to summarize here, Uber effect, AI effect, Amazon effect, longer term over the next decade is going to devastate jobs even more. The jobs that have been created are low-paid jobs, and it's the statistics grossly overestimate what it looks like. NAFTA is not going to bring tweaking. That's all NAFTA is. It's not going to bring jobs back. Federal rate hikes are going to devastate more jobs. The tax cuts going to result in more job reduction. None of this looks good long term for jobs, right? Just as the wage increases are really manipulated information here, and we're not getting any wage increases, well, the job data is also implemented. Future weeks, I'll be talking about how the infrastructure plans by Trump are really phony. And we'll be talking about what does this all mean for the destruction of unions, which is going on apace here. It used to be unions would be able to recoup wages for their workers and jobs after the recession. Well, that's not happening anymore. The labor movement, the union labor movement's almost been destroyed in the public private sector. Now they're going after the public sector. Well, next week we'll try to talk about what are some of these anti-union offensives that are underway and spreading and growing, and why isn't labor been able to stop them, and what does it need to do in order to stop them and to play a role once more in protecting the wages and jobs of his members. Okay, that will be next week. What are the new anti-labor offenses and what to do? What should labor do to do to this deteriorating condition state of the working class in America in year one of the Trump 2.0 neoliberal offensive? Okay, Jack Rasmus, we'll talk to you next week. I'm sure, boy, next week we may have some big news on the stock and bond markets as well. Okay, this is Alternative Visions.